Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. My dear regular readers and listeners, you likely sense a theme these past few weeks. Yes. Health Hats exist to learn on the journey towards best health, to make health choices and decisions. The journey and constellations of information, personality, technology, culture, and life constantly swirl, seldom aligning. We, individuals, as planets, seem to orbit as well. Somewhat habitual, hit with occasional inertia-busting forces. I'm not currently tripping on acid. Rather, these COVID-19 days feel like meteors that keep hitting and busting our inertia, blasting our strengths and weaknesses in high relief. Without desperately missed federal leadership and rare episodes of alignment, pods of entrepreneurs and connectors rush to fill the vacuum for profit or for good works. One of my many projects is working with AHRQ, the Agency for Health Research and Quality, part of the Federal Health and Human Services Department, and with the MITRE Corporation to create and populate a repository of computable clinical decision guidelines for public use. As the patient caregiver representative on the project, I advocate for these digital tools to be integrated into software apps and health records that lay people use. Simply put, I have questions about the medical health of me and mine. I should be able to find and trust research-informed guidance to help me make decisions about treatment and care with my medical team. I participate in these projects to encourage developers and academics to recognize us laypeople and our life flows in their design, coding, and use of this digital, computer-ready information. It is slow going, very slow going. My guest today is Sherry Binns, a registered nurse with an additional degree in gerontology and an internationally certified multiple sclerosis nurse. She is a regular presenter of patient education programs for the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation and a writer for M-Focus magazine. Sherry co-chairs the I Conquer MS Research Committee. She's a PCORI, Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute ambassador, peer reviewer, and merit reviewer, and a past member of the PCORNET Engagement Committee. Sherry was diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis in 1994 and has found that adopting some changes in her lifestyle has made her MS much easier to manage. Sherry and I work together with PCORI and PFCC partners. Sherry often provides words of wisdom and common sense in the arcana of research. Sherry, I'm so glad you could join me. I need your help. I appreciate that you're taking the time. How do you introduce yourself in a social situation?
It depends on what the situation is. It's a situation where I'm talking to somebody like you that I've met in a semi-professional situation, I'll just say, I'm Sherry, currently retired from clinical nursing, but I'm an internationally certified multiple sclerosis nurse. And I also, as I was aging and taking care of more elders, got an additional degree in gerontology to support that.
Okay.
If I were introducing myself in a situation where somebody needed to know a little about me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would introduce myself as Sherry, wife, mother, child of God, musical spirit, something of that nature.
Okay. Do you play an instrument?
At one point in my life, I played 13 different instruments.
Oh, my goodness.
Guitar and flute were my main instruments.
Yeah.
I really haven't done too much in the last few years because MS has affected my eyesight to the point where I can't tell if a note is a G or a B. I don't know which line it's on because I'm seeing two or three stops.
Yes. Can you tell me, say, in the last year or so, as you're navigating whatever ails you personally, and you are looking for evidence when you're just searching for research about, you know, making a decision about should I do this, should I do that, you know, how do you go about researching?
I think because of my background in nursing and as an advocate, as a home care case manager, I tend to go to professional sites a lot. So if I'm looking for what the best practice is in an area, I might go to the American College of Cardiology or the American Geriatric Society or the American Heart Association if I'm looking for something treatment specific. I know a lot of times you mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that we tend to zero in on our area of communication or expertise. I just like to refer to that as tunnel vision.
Okay.
I mean, we're tunneled in the area of nephrology if we're dealing with high blood pressure. We're tunneled in the area of cardiology if we're dealing with atrial fibrillation. It's like the blind man and the elephant. Nobody's seeing the whole picture. If there are a number of different things going on, I personally, in addition to living with multiple sclerosis, also have a hereditary propensity to hypertension, obesity, thyroid disease, diabetes. So I'm kind of juggling all these different things. So I need to be aware of the different sites for endocrinology or for cardiology or are those different disciplines to deal with that, to know what the best practices are. I think oftentimes you go to the doctor and your blood pressure might be up a little and they want to give you something for your blood pressure. And it's often a trial and error sort of thing. I've tried just about every class of blood pressure medicines and they all raise my blood pressure. I have opposite reactions.
Okay, yes.
So I've found one class of drugs and only one drug in that class that works for me. Mm-hmm. But it took going to those sites and finding out what was recommended and how I might be able to recommend tweaks to that. And fortunately, I had a wonderful nephrologist who really keeps up on education, really keeps up on cross-discipline.
Their education, the clinician's education.
Yep.
Yes. Okay.
So they're good with the cross-discipline and understand why others might recommend certain things. And that can often forestall adverse interactions between treatment plans.
When you say professional association, you're thinking about clinical professional associations.
Yeah.
How do you use peer groups when you're exploring options?
You mean something like a Facebook page?
Well, yeah. I mean, people congregate in all sorts of different ways. Some belong to like the MS Association. Some people, you do Facebook pages. Some people do Twitter. I don't know. People do all sorts of different things. But when, as opposed to there's the clinical expertise and then there's a lived experience expertise, which are very different sometimes. Uh-huh. So I'm just wondering, how do you make use of that angle?
If there's a clinical question, if somebody's asking me, I've got this, this, and this going on, my doctor's recommending that I take this disease-modifying therapy, what are the implications?
Yeah.
I will take that to the International Organization of MS Nurses chat page. So we talk with each other about what's recommended, why, what are the ramifications of following this protocol versus this protocol. I just really feel as a retired healthcare professional that I need somebody else who understands this lived experience from the same lens that I do.
Okay.
I go to a group that we've recently started on Facebook for medical professionals with multiple sclerosis.
Oh, okay.
We've all got some degree of scientific training. That lens for us is a more professional lens than somebody who hasn't been through medical school or nursing school or physical therapy school or pharmacy school.
So the combination of peer of lived experience with a condition plus a similar professional background is a sweet spot for you.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, that's great.
I sometimes find that if I'm on a group for people just with MS, for example, we've got a huge range of age and life experience. We've got young people who are newly diagnosed who don't know what the future holds. We've got those of us like myself who've been symptomatic for more than four decades and have learned to navigate it. Yeah. And so you've got the wisdom seekers and you've got the wisdom sharers on groups like that. Yeah. But I don't often find that those are the best places for me to get the support that I might need at a given point in time.
Okay.
Maybe a place for me to lend support.
I see. Oh, that, okay.
So
that makes sense.
I think we need not to limit ourselves to something that's just self-serving.
Okay. Interesting. So tell me a little bit about iConquer MS.
iConquer MS came out of the PCORI, Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Initiative group. PCORI has a whole network of organizations like iConquer MS. Some of them are disease-specific. Some of them are what they call clinical data networks, like Duke University, Kaiser Permanente. Those groups do a lot of research and use several organizations. The patient-powered research networks, which iConquer MS is, are generally condition-specific. Sometimes they lump similar conditions together. But they use the patient voice to guide their research. So maybe you're in a later phase of a disease process, such as I am, having had MS for more than 40 years, and you don't necessarily think that a cure for MS is where you need to be looking. Maybe your question is, how can I live the best quality of life that I possibly can? What goes into that? Are there dietary changes? Are there supplements I should be taking? What exercise is right? And so people who are members of these networks direct research along those lines. And oftentimes it's not like lengthy drug trial research that networks. It might be lifestyle changes. It might be if you're taking this drug, then you may not need to take this drug. It may be things that relate to what we call deprescribing, taking people off of a medication that might have adverse effect and is giving maybe minimal benefit or is just being given as a preventive. So platform, I started about 6 years ago when the organization got out of its infancy. It's a brainchild of the Accelerated Cure Project for MS, which has been a not-for-profit that has a biorepository, is sharing that information with researchers.
Okay, wait a minute. Biorepository, tell me what that is.
A biorepository, and there are several of these around the country. Some of them are disease-specific. Some of them are general for researchers to use. So a person might donate blood that can be used by researchers to see if they can find, for example, biomarkers that might make them more predisposed to a benefit from a certain therapy.
So genetics, maybe.
It may be genetics. It's certainly genetics is a big area of research where this is concerned. But one person donating blood can go to 50 different researchers.
Oh, okay.
So those 50 different researchers might be looking at 30 different topics, but there might be similar data points that are coming out in their research. What the biorepositories do and what the patient-powered research networks do and what PCORI does is it requires anybody whose research they cooperate with, who shares their data, de-identified data with a research network, that that researcher then give back the information gleaned from their research to the organization.
Okay.
So if for example, we have a researcher coming to us and looking at mindfulness techniques, and does that reduce stress levels? Does it improve mood? How are they measuring that in people with MS? We might reach out to our 6,000 plus or minus member database and ask them if anybody is interested in participating in with a researcher, collaborating with a researcher on this project. So that engagement might look different at different levels. We might have a group of people that wants to help to design the research question. We might have a group of people that wants to help recruit to the research project. We might have another group, generally our largest group, that's more than willing to answer surveys related to this researcher's interests or questions. We might have another group that is willing to review the information gathered and another group that is into disseminating that information. Okay. So every researcher, you know, those are different layers of participation within these organizations, and they all have very similar focus on how that information is handled. Many of those practices are sort of laid out by PCORI as suggested ways to do business.
Now, my understanding that there's a standard set of survey questions that people who are participating in iConquer MS may be filling out over time that's available for researchers to use. And then researchers may have a specific question that then they're adding.
Adding another layer.
Okay. And
so when somebody becomes a member of iConquer MS, they fill out a basic survey that gives us demographic information. White, female, 57 years old with secondary progressive MS on this medication, this location. We find that our database is pretty evenly matched as far as gender to the national population with the National MS Society statistics. About 75% are female, about 25% are male. We do find, however, that our network is a little bit older than perhaps the general population. And, you know, I think that may be because the older we get, the more free time we have to do these surveys to keep up with things. We also maybe have more experience, so we want to add our voice to that experiential gathering of information. We are not as ethnically diverse as I would like to see us be. I think something like 5% or 7% of our members are of African descent, and maybe 8 or 9% are of Hispanic descent. So maybe 2 or 3% of Asian descent. So we don't have as ethnically diverse a group as we'd like to see. So it may not fully reflect to some researchers the demographic that they're looking for. Now, every 6 months, we send out all of those surveys again particularly those that are looking at the disease course, if there have been medication changes, which symptoms are more prominent, what they found for symptom relief, so that we can track that individual's specific symptoms and disease course over time. If you've been in the system for 4 years, you've now got 8 different data points. So you can see, is your MS decreasing in severity? Mm-hmm. Are you sawtoothing? Yeah. We've also got a diary component, so you can tick in started new medicine at this date, mm-hmm. or started exercise program here, or began mindfulness practice,
right.
and see if there's a correlation between those interventions and along the course of this, how your disease is progressing. And researchers are really looking for that kind of information because there's not a lot of it out there.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge to record your doctor visit. Push the big pink button and record the conversation. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app at abridge.com, ABRIDGE.com, or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went. Yeah. Let's go back to the question of health equity. So how does, as an organization, how do they work to increase the range of participants, to seek out communities that aren't represented as much as maybe they actually are in the population?
PCORI has engagement awards that they will give to groups. And we got an engagement award a couple of years ago to look at minority participation in research.
Mm-hmm.
The individuals that spearheaded that within the organization were a couple of African-American females and one Latina.
Mm-hmm.
And they reached out to communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
And did focus groups within those communities, looking at what their needs were, what the perceived deficits were, where they thought the fault lay in not getting the same level of mm-hmm. care that their white counterparts were perhaps getting.
Yeah.
And what we saw with all of that was that people want to participate in research. They want to lend their voices. They feel that their voices have value, but nobody's asking them.
Oh, okay. Oh.
I think that in and of itself tells us that we need to stop just looking at the people who've come to us,
mm-hmm.
but we need to begin to reach out to others through the resources that we have available. If you're an African-American male, you probably know a lot of African-American males who have similar life experiences. Mm-hmm. Start a subgroup. Mm-hmm. Get people together on a specific topic or a support arena. Mm-hmm. And then share that information back with us so that we know how to tweak what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I do have to say that after 6 years on the research committee with iConquerMS, I'm seeing a real evolution with the questions that we're asking people, the people that are reaching out to us to give input,
mm-hmm.
the networks that are being broadened by people sharing, well, you know, I just found out about this resource. Why don't you go check it out? Because I found this on it that I hadn't been able to find anyplace else. Mm-hmm. So it's mm-hmm. that information sharing.
Yeah. One of the things that I see in my work is the misalignment of questions people are asking about their lives, so they're satisfied with their lives, and the research that's being done. That oftentimes researchers are, the funding for research or the research that's being done, again, there's a mismatch. What do you think about that? What's been your experience with that? Because you're really invested in both sides, in the research side and the layperson side.
I think it all boils down to listening skills.
Okay.
If I want somebody to listen to me and what's mm-hmm. important to me, I have to really listen to them and what's mm-hmm. important to them. So a researcher is going to come at this from a different angle than a patient is. It's important that they listen to each other's voices to see if maybe they're looking for the same result. They're just wording it differently. Okay. And that's why it's so important to have the patient voice involved in the development of the research question.
Okay.
If you sit down with a patient focus group, maybe a half dozen different patient voices, different ages, different experiences, mm-hmm. and they sit with a group of researchers, a 2 or 3 hour conversation can start here, go to here, and end mm-hmm. up in the middle. Mm-hmm. It ends up with both sides mm-hmm. being drawn to the middle because they find a commonality.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes if the research is being done that's contrary to or not yet aligned with the patient voice, mm-hmm. it's because the two haven't taken the time to listen.
Well, another part to me is that often what happens is the money, the power, the questions are with the researchers, and then they seek to embed patients and caregivers in their process.
That's the thing.
And I'm involved with an organization now in Boston that is working with community-based organizations to say, well, what are the questions you guys are trying to handle, solve, learn about, and then be able to embed researchers in their organization, you know, taking it the other way.
Yeah.
What's been your experience with those kinds of community-based research, community-generated research questions, projects, whatever?
I think if you find community organizations that have a passion about getting answers to questions, that mm-hmm. have a passion about service, and I'm looking at not so much some of the larger organizations like the National MS Society, but maybe smaller groups like the MS Foundation, who
okay.
really are patient-centered. The majority of their operating budget goes directly to the patient in the form of program and service,
okay,
rather than to research.
Mm-hmm.
If you can activate that voice,
yeah.
If you can put that not-for-profit behind the patient voice, mm-hmm. it has greater power than the patient voice alone. So
yes.
there's a greater potential for the embedding of the research voice in that not-for-profit voice
yeah.
than there is for embedding the patient voice within the research voice. Does that make sense to
oh,
you?
Totally makes sense. When I have met researchers, you know, in my PCORI experience, most of the researchers that I know are through my PCORI experience. Those researchers that are very comfortable with not being in charge, working with community organizations and following their lead in terms of the research and then paying attention to the integrity of the research, but answering a question, working with the communities, those researchers are precious. You know, and it is a whole different conversation. Actually, I find that I learn myself a lot more about research from those scientists that are very comfortable with that because they're more patient with my quote unquote stupid questions.
The only stupid question yeah. is one that doesn't get asked.
There you go. So what do you think I should be asking you in this conversation that I'm not?
Well, I want to make an observation about PCORI.
Okay.
When I first learned about PCORI probably 7 or 8 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when I went to my first PCORI annual meeting, which was the first annual meeting of PCORI, mm-hmm. I saw researchers getting up there in panels. I saw them doing the presentations. They might have one patient on their panel, and that patient rarely ever said a word. The evolution over that interim, 6 years out, now has the researchers and the patients giving portions of each presentation that are essentially an equal amount of information, but from different perspectives. Or they have the patient presenting the information and the researcher giving an alternate view or an additional fill-in view. So PCORI is evolving.
Yes.
That patient voice in research is evolving. We've always been there, but I think it's more important than ever right now that we learn how to most effectively train up those patient voices, help people to find their voice, help people to target what is really important to them as an individual or to them as a community. Are they food secure? Are they able to get fresh produce that's healthy? Are they in a community where there are farmers markets or where there's excess produce that can be shared within the community? How do they access that?
Yeah.
Those are things that, particularly as we're shut down with COVID right now, are real concerns that I'm hearing from people. How do I, the supply chain has been interrupted.
Yes.
How do I make sure I'm getting what I need to get to take care of the physical plant so that I'm not at risk for getting sick? And we need to also give people an idea of where their voice can be shared for the greatest impact.
More about that, where the voice can be shared. Like, give me some examples. What do you mean by that?
People can call up their local hospital or health system, ask if they have a patient advisory council.
Okay.
Ask if they don't have a patient advisory council, if they would like one. Go to Patient and Family Advisory Network, pfccpartners.com, and ask for information on how to start an advisory network and get that patient voice meeting and speaking with each other so that they can come up with ways to share with healthcare practitioners, policymakers, ways to more effectively get the word out or get people to buy into recommendations that have been thought to be or found to be helpful in improving quality of life or longevity.
Sherry, I've seen throughout my career as a nurse and then as a patient caregiver activist, is this such a heavy focus medical institutions and very little focus on public health. And now that's, you know, just kicking us in the ass with COVID that we have so underinvested. Now, taking your MS research nurse experience, what are the opportunities you see in that public health versus the hospital, you know, arena?
We're great teachers. I don't know a nurse in my 45 years as a nurse. I don't know a nurse who isn't a good teacher, who can't put across to even the least literate among us, whether it be a small child or whether it be an adult who is maybe at the opposite end of the spectrum and is cognitively impaired. Take a concept to the least and teach it in a manner that can be taken forward. We're so focused in this day and age on illness and on tending to illness, and we're not focused on health and making health the pervasive. And in order to do that, we need to take those messages into the home, into the schools, into the community centers. We need to take it outside of the healthcare institutions. The more of us that have adopted lifestyle changes that have improved our quality of life and just start sharing that with people. I'm not in pain anymore now that I've eliminated sugar from my diet. Those sorts of things, they're simple things we're a lived experiential voice in that we can share with people. But I think it needs to be taken into the community and out of the healthcare institution.
Anything you'd like to ask me?
You sent me a link when you asked me to participate in that about CDS, Clinical Decision Support.
Yes, CDS Connect, yes.
CDS Connect, and yes. It's part of the Health and Human Services?
It's part of AHRQ, ARC. It's a ARC-funded initiative as a repository of computable clinical guidelines.
One thing you may want to take back to them is that it's difficult to search things from their site.
Oh.
I put in 5 different queries this morning when I was looking at the site. It says it supports research. Mm-hmm. So I put in a query of multiple sclerosis and stem cell research.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, no results found. I mm-hmm. put in a query of aging and brain health.
Mm-hmm.
No results found. I mm-hmm. put in a query for healthy heart protocols. Nothing found. And then 2 more that were a little less specific,
mm-hmm.
nothing found. Every query that I put in, there were no results to be found. So maybe it's a site that's just being built and hasn't been populated yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looks like to me. It's certainly after that first round in there, if it doesn't say anything about, please bear with us as we build this site. So it will not be a site that I revisit. I think that they're not doing themselves a favor by having put the site up without a notification that they're building it and not populating it and not getting information into it as it becomes available.
That's a really good point, because one of the projects that I'm working on right now is the findability of evidence. And it's a very interesting dilemma, this tagging of resources. Usually tagging, categorization, the metadata of, you know, data about data uses PubMed or, you know, medical librarian type of categorization, and not terms that come from questions people have. And you're at this spot sort of in the middle, where you have your professional and research expertise and you're very in touch with the lay life. So you're searching for what's of interest to you, didn't pull up anything. So that whole business of findability, it's not there or it's not findable. And those are both dilemmas, aren't they? Yeah. So thank you for that feedback. I'll share that. That's great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for asking me, Danny.
Yeah. So we'll talk. I'm sure we'll talk. Okay.
All
thanks.
Right.
Thanks very much.
You take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Sherry straddles the three worlds of chronic illness, clinician, and researcher. She's a leader, an influencer, and a connector. I appreciate that Sherry took the time to explore CDS Connect. We welcome her critique about findability. She used academic and medical terms and didn't find what she sought. Sherry honed her searching strategies as a clinician, patient, and advocate. She will not likely add CDS Connect to her repertoire. Research and technology often act with a presumptive, build it and they will come attitude. Unless you're building and marketing an iPhone, that approach is seldom successful. Traditionally, clinical decision support developers view app and software developers as their customers, not lay people, patients and caregivers. Sherry represents a middle ground, informed influencer and decision maker. If Sherry had found the Library of Computable Clinical Guidelines useful, she would have shared the resource with her professional and advocacy peers and the groups they represent. Sustainable use is the prize. Expanding the diversity of stakeholders at the tables of healthcare governance, design, operations, and learning can help reach that prize. not just diversity of users, lay people, but diversity of skills and perspectives. Design and marketing, not just scientists, clinicians, and academia. My antenna flickered as Sherry and I spoke about equity and research plan recruitment analysis and sharing of results. Often equity and inclusion conversations focus on matching proportion of gender, race, and ethnicity in the study participants to the general population. Meaningful equity and inclusion progress occurs when studies address the varying needs of less well-represented groups. I saw an example when reviewing PCORI funding requests. It was budgeting for respite care so caregivers could leave their carees and participate. Brilliant, but isolated. Do you know of other model approaches to inclusion innovation? Please share. I know the righteousness of computable clinical guidelines in my gut. We need a different approach, though. See the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, www.health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.